Canada, to talk about being free, to talk about having the courage of your conscience, the character of conviction, and not to reduce everything to the lowest common denominator, to moral relativism and to political correctness. Last night we spent the hour celebrating the 50th anniversary of the Hungarian Revolution and rose up as one against steel and bullets and fire. And though it was put down, the drama at short fall led eventually to the Prague Spring of 67, led eventually to the liberation in Poland, led eventually to the fall of the Soviet Union. Rules make the difference. Hungarians in 1956 could have said, we won't go up against the government. We don't care what's outside our borders. We'll sell our birthright and our consciences and our individual consequence for some extra little dollars from the state. But they chose not to. They chose to be free. And that's a problem that Canadians have a big, big issue understanding. We have grown up in a generation of political equivalency, moral relativism, where we cannot see right from wrong anymore. We are a society that dares not care. We are people running between the raindrops. We claim to be proud of this wonderful world of social justice that we supposedly have built up, except that world of social justice is being corroded every single day by government intrusion into our lives, by government deceptions and duplicity that turn black to white, white to black, where bad and evil men prey on the just and innocent. We have taken law, and instead of making it the shield of the honest and the staff of the just, have made it a two-edged sword of craft and oppression. And every now and then, however, people stand up and say enough. And this is not just a sickness in Canada, it's endemic in North America. We have a bold and brave new prime minister today who's trying to share with us and move us toward a new vision. But we have to be ready to hear and accept that vision. We can't not care anymore. And that was the reason why we at the Institute for Public Affairs of Montreal decided tomorrow to hold a conference called the Questions of Values. What do we stand for as Canadians? Where do we draw the line in the sand, and particularly as it relates to the challenge that radical Islam is putting to us? And the reason why that's the focus is because that's the preeminent existential issue that will define our fate. We cannot sit idly by and think that we can protect our world here while ignoring the millions under oppression abroad. That won't happen. And the reason why it's important to talk about it today in this country, in this province, and particularly in this city, is because unlike any other city in the Western world, on August the 6th, we had a rally in the city that did nothing but support the worst elements of radical Islam. It was a rally in support of Hezbollah. It was the only rally in the Western world where at its lead were leaders of civil and political society. That didn't happen anywhere in the Western world. And it's time we got the message. And this isn't a message about geopolitical tactics. This isn't a message about military strength. This is a message that comes from authentic and legitimate voices of people who've suffered under theocratic tyranny, under the attempted imposition of hegemony, or are working to help people who are suffering under it. And if we don't have the courage to stand with these people, to stand with these clarion calls, to stand with these profiles in courage, then we don't have a right to call ourselves a member of the family of free nations. And what we decide to do will determine a great deal of the future of this country, whether we are the true North, strong and free, true to what is just, loyal to freedom, strong in our resolve to oppose tyranny, or whether we're just going to go along to get along and for a little extra money in our checks from the government, deliver our mothers to the state and for whatever, anything it wants. That is the crossroads that Canada stands today. And that's what we're going to examine this whole hour with three of our four guests at the conference tomorrow. And we'll be right back with you after this. And tonight we're talking about the values What do we value as Canadians? What is going to be our ways of response to the Islamist challenge? Not militarily. Here, at home, when do we say, this is what we believe. This is the secular freedoms that we believe in. Practice encroaching on us. Governments. Everything is not relative. The Institute for Public Affairs is holding a conference on this tomorrow at the Delta Hotel between 1:30 and 4:30, and we're proud to have three of our four speakers from that conference with us in studio today. Bridget Gabriel, Lebanese-born, suffered from Islamist violence as a child, went on to become a major broadcaster in the Middle East, came to America, founded the American Congress for Truth, and is the author of Because They Hate. Nani Darwish from Egypt, her family recovered from the effects of an Islamist environment, lost a father indirectly because of it, knows about Israeli-Egyptian violence, founding member, president of Arabs for Israel. Nazanin Afshinjan from Vancouver, former Miss World Canada, put aside personal ambition, put aside career, to take up the cause of one young girl named Nazanin also, Nazanin Fatehi, who, living under the Sharia law of Iran, was sentenced to death for stabbing the man who raped her. Because under that form of justice, it can't be determined that she was raped without four male witnesses. These are profiles in courage, Canada. Profiles in courage that we need to follow and understand. Because one brave and bold new prime minister is not enough. Each of us has to stop running between the raindrops. Each of us has to dare to care. And each of us has to be ready to look our society in the mirror and say, it can no longer tell right from wrong. Welcome, Bridget. Welcome, Nani. Welcome, Nazanin.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's start from left to right. Bridget Gabriel, you're on everywhere with this message. You've been threatened. You've been harassed. You've been cajoled. What drives you?
We must protect our freedoms. We must fight for everything we cherish, our freedom of speech, our freedom of religion. The freedoms that we cherish in the West that are under threat right now from radical Islamic fundamentalism that's spreading all around the world and threatening us here in North America.
But how did you decide to start this?
The decision started after 9/11. I'm a survivor of the war in Lebanon. I was wounded when I was 10 years old. My home was blown up, and I was buried under the rubble, wounded. And I ended up in a hospital for 2.5 months. And I would ask my parents, why did they do this to us? Why did the Muslims bomb us? And my parents would explain, because we are infidels, the Muslims want to kill us because we are Christians. So I knew since I was 10 years old that I wanted dead simply because I was born into the Christian faith. I ended up living
You make no distinction in a lot of the speeches that you give, and you've been a guest on this show. You make no distinction, and you've been criticized for it. You use the generic word Muslims. You don't make a distinction between radical Islam, Islamism. You use the word Muslim, period. Why?
Because in Lebanon, the Muslims who started massacring the Christians in the Middle East were not radicals. Radical Muslims is an invention by the politically correct West that has lost its tongue to political correctness. And this is going to be the beginning of our demise unless we start identifying and judging people by their actions. In Lebanon, the massacring, and throughout the Middle East, under the banner of La ilaha illallah, Muhammadun Rasulullah, there is no God greater than Allah and Muhammad and his prophet. They killed children in Israel, they massacred Christians in Lebanon, Copts in Egypt, Assyrians in Syria, Armenians in Turkey, Hindus in India, all in the name of Allah. They were not radicals, they were Muslims who turned against their own population. In Lebanon, it wasn't the radical Muslims that turned against us, they were the doctors, the lawyers, the accountants, the educated ones, the ones with the master's degrees. They were not radicals, they were good Muslims practicing the Islamic religion. And we in the West, until we hear from the Islamic community who's going to stand up and defend the freedoms of the West that we all cherish, then I can call those moderate Muslims. But at this point, unless they differentiate themselves, so far all we hear about is excuses from supposedly moderate Muslims in the West making excuses and apologies for the radicals committing their acts.
We're going to get back to that, and we're going to get back to whether there's a difference between Muslim radicals and the Arab street, as the press likes to call it. But let's go on to Nani for a second. Nani, your story is a very personal one of what happened to you and your family in Egypt. I'd like you to tell it.
I was born in Cairo. Grew up in Gaza in the 50s. My father headed the Egyptian military intelligence in Gaza, and the Fida'iyin.
The Fida'iyin were Arab guerrillas attacking Israel crossing the border from Gaza.
Correct. And they caused a lot of damage, destruction, and death inside Israel. They were not at that time suicide bombers, but they did terrorize Israel. And my father was eventually killed. He was assassinated, the first assassination by Israel because of Fida'iyin to defend themselves.
Now, was this a targeted assassination by Israel part of bombing?
Targeted assassination.
So you should have instinctively felt a great deal of bitterness towards Israel.
I was.
And toward the West.
Very bitter. I was indoctrinated to hate Jews, just like all the Arab kids were. We thought they were monsters. Any minority in the Middle East is totally rejected and treated as second-class citizens, especially the Copts in Egypt. And just to comment on the radical or not radical Islam, I think there are very few differences between radicals in general. There are non-practicing Muslim radicals. There are just political Muslim radicals. There are secular Muslim radicals, and they all together, put together, they are in a war with the West.
Nani
for
Darwish,
different reasons.
We'll be right back, and Canada will be right back with Nazanin Afshinjan right after this break. And we're discussing questions of values. We're on to the Islamist Challenge. The Institute for Public Affairs is holding this conference tomorrow at the Delta Hotel between 1:30 to 4:30. Admission is open to the public. Special guests in studio are three of our four speakers: Bridget Gabriel, founder of the American Congress for Truth and author of Because They Hate, Nani Darwish, Arabs for Israel, and the upcoming book, Now They Call Me Infidel, and Nazanin Afshinjan, former Miss World Canada, who's taken on the cause of Nazanin Fatahi, a 18-year-old girl in Iran sentenced to for stabbing her rapist. We're just going to continue with Nani Darwish. Nani, we're telling the story of your father. Your father was training Fida'iyin, Egyptian officer, targeted for assassination by Israel. My question to you before the break was, you should have been real bitter at the West and at Israel. What happened when you left, or what happened when you came to America?
I was bitter, indoctrinated with lots of hate, just like all Arab kids. Actually, after my father's death, a large number of Egyptian high Egyptian officials, together with Nasser, came to our house, and they lined us up, us five children, and they asked us, which one of you will cleanse the death of your dad by his blood by killing Jews? And I remember I looked at my brothers and sister, and I was just speechless. We couldn't answer. We were in mourning for our father's death. The last thing we wanted to be burdened with is to find somebody to kill, a Jew to kill. And that's when I rejected, and something inside me said, I hate the word shaheed and jihad, but I couldn't dare say
shaheed, the Arab word from martyr, jihad, the Arab word from holy war.
Correct. And I couldn't dare say it because it was against all the value system we grew up with. So I felt that that took away my father. And I just left. We moved to Cairo. After that, we left Gaza, and my mother had to suffer a lot of oppression of women. For example, she wanted to buy a car at a time in Egypt when very few women drove cars in the 50s. And my mom bought a car to drive us to school, five children, and she was called names by the neighbors, like, what a loose woman would go buy a car. She's a widow. Well, what kind of a loose woman is she? And I remember seeing my mom cry. She said, well, they take our husbands as shaheeds, and they give us no respect because our home has no man.
How soon after that did you leave Egypt?
I lived in Egypt until I was almost 30 years old. I went to the American University in Cairo. I went to a British school, and I had a touch of Western education. And I wanted to go to America because I lived through the tyranny and a dictatorship of Nasser. For 30 years, I lived through oppression of women, female genital mutilation.
Nani, sorry, hold the thought. We'll be right back. And you can email us with your comments after the show at info@iapm.ca. We're talking with three of our four guests at the Institute Conference tomorrow. Questions of values, ways of response to the Islamist challenge. We held at Delta Centreville Hotel between 1:30 and 4:30. And with us in studio is Bridget Gabriel, author of Because They Hate and founder of the American Congress of Truth. Nazanin Afsanjan, who's launched an international effort on behalf of a young lady named Nazanin Fatia, who has been sentenced to death for stabbing her rapist, and she focuses worldwide attention on the lowly status of women, unfortunately, in Iran and throughout the Muslim world. And we're talking to Nani Darwish, Egyptian-born, founder of Arabs for Israel, and author of the upcoming Now They Call Me Infidel. Nani, before the break, you were talking about how you spent your life in Egypt, and when was the decision made to come to America?
In 1978, I moved to the States. And it was the first
time... Speak just a bit closer to the mic.
Yeah, it was the first time for me to see and meet Jews, because they were all gone, expelled from Egypt. And I discovered that when I'm among my Jewish friends, I always heard the word shalom, compassion, forgiveness, tolerance. When can we have peace with Arabs? And when I was among my Arab friends, my Muslim friends, I never heard the word, we want peace. It was always, we're here, we want to Islamize America. We will never have peace with Israel. There was never any humanitarian attempts to reach out for Jewish people.
How did Arabs for Israel start?
After 9/11, I did a lot of soul searching. I was extremely shocked after 9/11, and I... It just dawned on me that this little country has been the victim of constant terrorism by my culture. Terrorism wars, constant wars, and a very severe boycott. And I felt it's time for me to speak out. I wanted to speak out earlier, but I was too scared.
But 9/11 was an attack on the West. It wasn't necessarily an attack on Israel. Israel, yes, the frontline nation and the family of free nations. Was that the reason for calling it Arabs for Israel as opposed to something else?
Well, I of course I speak out.
Was it the message and the metaphor?
Yeah, it's a metaphor, but I wanted to speak for America, number one. My motivation was to speak at least out of respect for the 3,000 fellow Americans who died on that day. But Israel has been, because I became, as an American, I became the victim of terror. Then I discovered how horrific that could be for Israel, and I started my website Arabs for Israel because I wanted to bring out more and more voices of Arabs who speak for peace with Israel. And there are, if you go on the website and you click on Arab emails, you'll find tons of Arabs who want to live in peace with Israel, but they are too scared to speak it.
I want to get back to that, and I want to get back to a theme that you and Bridget brought out. That's a very troubling theme, but first. Nazanin Afsanjan, you have a similar story, but not that similar. Nazanin leaves Iran as a young girl, comes to Canada, and proves everything, brains, brawn, beauty. You become an air cadet. You reach the highest level. You go to the Etude Internationale de Sciences Politiques, and you become Miss World Canada, first runner-up. So with all that fame and celebrity staring at you, you put that all aside for the past 2 years to bring attention on the case of Nazanin Fateh and the case of and focus attention on the status of women in Iran. Why? How did that happen?
Well,
you prove yourself
right. I didn't put it aside, but I used it as a platform to speak on issues of human rights, women's rights, and responsibility. I think everyone that has a voice must use it. We have to be the voice for the voiceless. So this year I was working on a music album, and through my songs, I try to bring messages about rights. And when I heard about the case of Nazanin Fateh...
You've written a song called Someday about Nazanin Fateh, which we played on the show.
Mm-hmm. I wrote it, and I had to put it on hold for a while, because when you have the life of an individual on your shoulders, with your daily existence... Mm-hmm. It's constantly on your mind.
It was fascinating how you got involved. Could you tell our audience about how somebody reached you about the case?
Mm-hmm.
How did that happen?
He actually read the story first in an Iranian newspaper called Etemad, and he went online to search more about this Nazanin Fatehi. And because I have the most, when you Google Nazanin, he actually reached my website, And he ended up telling me about the story, and I was shocked and horrified by it.
And this fellow was from where?
He was from Paris. He's from Paris, and recently he told me I can say his name. His name is Vincent Manouri. Before, he was really scared, and he said through the last 6 months, 7 months that I've been working on this campaign, he's gained the courage. He said, you know what? If we can't speak out, who will?
Nazanin, I want to ask you about what he said to you when he called you, because it's an important part of this story. We're going to be right back after we pay some bills and discuss that. And tonight we're talking with three of our four speakers at tomorrow's conference, Questions of Values, Ways of Responsibility. We're in conversation now with Nazanin Afshinjan, former Miss World Canada, who's taken on the cause of Nazanin Fatahi, young Iranian girl sentenced to death for stabbing the man who raped her. Nazanin, in worldwide tours and speaking engagements, has shed light on the status of women, the sad status of women, both in Iran and throughout the Arab Muslim world. Nazanin, before the break, you were telling us that the man originally called you about the Nazanin Fatahi case, just recently allowed you to use his name. What was he afraid of?
People who are signing the petition to help save her life are afraid to put their real name in case.
But you came out visibly.
I did. I had no choice.
And the guy who called you to do it, what was his concern? He's living in Paris.
He was living in Paris, but I suspect he would want to return to Iran one day, and he was afraid that he would be imprisoned. Whereas I've already spoken out many times, I'm no longer afraid, you know, if they're going to do something to me. Well, then.
And you don't just speak out in Canada. You brought the message, and a Canadian message. You just came back from Berlin, where you were part of Amnesty International's Day Against the Death Penalty.
Yes.
At the Potsdamer Platz.
Yes, they were focusing on the executions of child minors in Iran. So they invited me as their main speaker, and I brought to light the case of Nazanin Fatahi, Kobra Rahmanpour, and so many other young people up for execution.
Remarkable. Let's go to the lines, because they're lighting up a bit. We'll take one caller. Brian, good evening.
Yeah, good evening, Beryl. You know, I understand and I sympathize totally with what I'm hearing, and even the thought of the girl being raped, it brings, you know, my eyes tear up when I think about it.
You mean we shouldn't be morally relative in our good Canadian fashion and say, well, that's a culture who's got a right to be wrong?
Well, you know, but the thing is,
it makes me angry. I don't want to sympathize. I want righteous indignation.
It makes me angry, but the thing is that the West cannot invade every country on the planet.
You know what? You're absolutely right. The West doesn't have to invade, but there's a lot of things short of invasion.
Okay.
A lot of people forget.
Then I'm with you.
Brian, a lot of people forget the first crack in the wall of the Iron Curtain against the Soviet Union came when two brave American politicians, Senator Henry Jackson and Congressman Charles Vanek, stood up in the late 70s and said, big business, you want to do business with Russia because they have cheap labor? No more.
Okay.
No most favored nation trading status until they give political dissidents freedom, until they let Soviet Jews emigrate.
Okay.
In 1981, America led Europe to accept the Helsinki Final Act, where all European nations took the Soviet Union off MFN status. Why can't we do the same today against tyrannies like China and Iran? Why are we doing business with killers?
I agree 100%. Like, that kind of thing, in those kind of ways, bring pressure to bear in... But you know, also I want to. There's something going on in Afghanistan. There's a dirty little secret about all that, and that's that the Pakistan is supporting the Taliban.
It's not such a secret anymore.
I know, and that has to be dealt with. I mean, like Canada.
Well, and you know what? And that's one of the reasons why America signed a nuclear agreement with the world's largest democracy, India, this year. Before that, they'd only had agreements with Pakistan. They realized that Pakistan is not a reliable ally. By the same token. Those are going to be long-term solutions, Brian. But we in this country, for example, right here at home, and that's the questions of values I'm talking about. We've got a brave, bold new prime minister with a minority government. But we have a problem. And one of the problems is not only doing business with Arab tyrannies, but doing business with the world's largest tyranny, which is China. Imagine,
yeah.
You want to get mad? Get mad at this. We're a $1 trillion economy. China's an $8 trillion economy. Under 10 years of 13 years of liberal government, we have funded 50 cents of every dollar that China spends in Canada. Meanwhile, we exported just last year alone 40,000 textile jobs to China. Why? Because big business wanted cheap labor. Now, how do we reverse that? This is a government.
But eventually, it's going to take time, but eventually that cheap labor situation is going to disappear. Everything's going to even out.
Why don't we get up in the streets and why don't we give the support to the Harper government that has said that it wants to stop trading with tyrannies to actually hear from the Canadian people that, yeah, you know, we're ready to do it. We're ready to pay more
for quality. It's not, you know, there's not a race to the bottom line. Walmart may be able to give you something that's 25 cents cheaper, but it ain't going to do anybody too much good if they haven't got a job to buy it with.
Yeah, I understand. Now, the thing I think that needs to be dealt with is Pakistan's support of the Taliban, because as long as that's happening, we're wasting our time being there.
You're absolutely right. But one thing that frustrates me is we just finished Operation Medusa, Canadian-led military operation out of Kandahar province that went across the border into Pakistan, wiped out a lot of the nests of the Taliban.
Yeah.
This was a heroic and successful mission, even by the standards of British generals that have been critical of American policy. Yet we don't hear about it in Canada. We don't know how to celebrate our own mythology.
If you pay attention, that's the one thing a lot of things that Canadians don't do is we don't do our homework when it comes to
no, we
things.
Don't.
And I paid attention. I heard about it.
Yep. There's you, me, and 10 others. Now what do we do?
But the thing about it is because of the Pakistani support, 2 weeks later it meant nothing. 2 weeks later, it's they're back putting the pressure on us.
You're absolutely right.
That has to be dealt with. Anyway, thanks for the time, Beryl. It's good listening to you.
Pleasure. Thank you, Brian. We'll be right back after this. And we're talking with three of our four speakers from tomorrow's conference, Questions of Values, Ways of Response to the Islamist Challenge. It'll be held at the Delta Santa Vida Hotel between 1:30 and 4:30. Bridget Gabriel, Nani Darwish, Nazin and Afton Jenner in studio. I want to ask a general question of all three of you, but on a point that was brought out that Nani, you've mentioned, and Bridget, you've mentioned. And I want to know how far you want to take it, because I make a distinction generally when I speak between Islam and Islamism, Muslims and radical Muslims. You two don't seem to make that distinction. Now, am I wrong to make the distinction? Is North America wrong? Is the West wrong? Is there no difference between radical Muslims and the Arab street that supposedly has some moderation?
The difference between us and you is that we come from the Middle East and we know how they think. You were born and raised in a Western country and you are judging
Eastern European anyway.
By a country and others according to your Western standards. We were raised in the Middle East. We know the mentality. We know how they think. We know the Quran. We know the commandments of the Quran. We know how the Muslim culture operates in general. And we come from there. And we didn't come from there when we were 1 year old. Noni and I both North America as adults. I was in my mid-20s and Noni was in her early 30s. So we didn't leave the Middle East when we were babies and are just talking about stories we have heard.
Is there a fundamental incompatibility between Islam and freedom, number one, and is that the problem of state faith? And number two, Nazanin, because of that state faith, is that a major source of the difficulties of women's rights and the status of women and the status of children in the Islamic world? And we can start with either part of this question. Islam and democracy incompatible because of state faith?
I think the way it's taught so far, it's incompatible to democracy.
But I'm not talking about what is taught within Islam. I think all religions, if you take them literally,
exactly,
have problems. What's happened in the Islamic world is that there's never been a separation between state and faith,
exactly,
as there is in the West. Can there ever be?
I hope so. But the current situation now is that no Arab government is free to govern without fear from a coup d'etat, because the way religious leaders, Muslim leaders, teach Islam is always through anger, spreading anger, rage, and subversion against Arab governments. No Arab government is Muslim enough for them. Not even Saudi Arabia is Muslim enough for them.
So in that
dynamic, only tyrannical governments can survive in the Middle East.
Nazanin, state faith. The fact that the Muslim world has basically not ever had the kind of division that Europe had between religion and secular law, can the status of women ever be rectified?
Just to clarify, because Noni was talking when you asked me the question,
mm-hmm.
I believe all religions are fundamentally good, but I also believe in the separation of the church and the state. I believe in that there's a distinction between radical Islam and other Muslims, because my own grandmother, she was the most gentle woman in the world. She was a Muslim, and yet the Revolutionary Guards who jailed and tortured my own father, I believe they were radical Islamists. There's a distinction I see as political Islam versus Islam, the religion. Mm-hmm. So
that you see it, but do people on the street see it?
I think so. I mean, the thousands of people that write me emails on a daily basis from Iran.
No, I'm sorry. I didn't ask the question the right way. Do they hope for it? Or do they really see that there is a division between a political culture being raised anywhere in a Muslim nation and an end to state faith as the political culture?
When state faith is the political culture, then there's a problem. Because as we see, Iran, for example, is ruled under mm-hmm. Sharia law. That's Islamic-based law. And there's a lot of embedded discrimination within that law. Women, for example, are not allowed to travel or obtain a passport without the permission of their husbands. In the case of this young woman, Nazanin Fatehi, who's up for execution, she would have needed four male witnesses to basically legitimize her word. A woman's life is worth half that of a man. So when Islam is confused as a political statement, then there's a lot of problems.
Ladies, thank you very much. I look forward to being with you tomorrow. Delta Hotel, 1:30 to 4:30. Questions of value, ways of response to the Islamist challenge. Canada, remember, a nation of sheep will always beget a government of wolves. Stop being sheep. We're out of here.